Hello and welcome to Retrospecticus, a Simpsons history podcast. You're listening to the pilot episode.
Hey, hey, listeners. I'm Gareth Irons.
And I'm Tom Williamson.
And this is Retrospecticus, the Simpsons and modern history, together at last. In each edition, we'll discuss a Simpsons episode and a major historical happening from the time the episode first aired in the US. You'll go where we go, defile what we defile, eat who we eat. And this week, we are on our pilot episode. So, there is no episode as such. But I'm going to be discussing the Simpsons shorts from Tracy Ullman.
Indeed, and I'm going to give a general overview of what was going on in 1989, because basically what didn't happen in 1989, it was an incredibly exciting year.
Excellent. Well, it sounds like our listeners are in for an absolute treat. Before we get started on that, should we just give a quick overview of how we've come to The Simpsons and how we've come to wind up doing this?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're both big Simpsons fans. I'd imagine you're a bigger Simpsons fan than I am, but I'm kind of a modern history buff. I'm not a historian. I wish I was. I'm not an historian, I should say. But I find modern history, and especially everything that was going on around when The Simpsons was broadcast, I find all of that absolutely fascinating. And the thing is, the state of the world at the moment, if, like me, you're a lefty, liberal, wishy-washy, SJW, snowflake kind of person, then the world's a bit rubbish at the moment. So you've got Brexit going on, you've got Donald Trump in the White House. You know, what was a very short throwaway joke in that one episode of The Simpsons has now become a reality, and we all have to deal with it. So what I'm looking for from this show is just big dollops of nostalgia and just a bit of fun talking about The Simpsons. And in each episode, I'm going to hopefully tell what people will hopefully find an interesting story from what was going on at the time. But we're going to start off by talking about The Simpsons. So I don't think we really need to explain what The Simpsons is. I mean, you'd have to be living under a rock for the last 30 years to not know what The Simpsons is, surely.
Well, yes. I mean, it's to be hoped. The Simpsons... It sounds like I'm going to do it anyway. So, The Simpsons is an animated show, now the longest-running episodic show in American television history, having passed Gunsmoke one or two seasons back. It was an absolute pop culture phenomenon upon its debut back in 1989, although, as we will discover, there was only actually one episode of it aired in the 80s due to technical difficulties. That's all for the next episode, though, so I won't dwell on that. It's came over here on Sky TV back in the time, and you tell people this now, and they don't believe you, but back in the time when satellite television, and indeed anything except for the main four channels, was both rare and expensive. So it was almost an aspirational thing to be a Simpsons viewer in the early days. That's why I wasn't a Simpsons viewer in the early days, because I didn't have Sky. The first episode I saw was on a VHS, and it was Call of the Simpsons from the first season, so we'll be getting to that very soon, and I didn't like it. And that's the end of the podcast, folks. I actually did not like it, which is strange when you consider I am now a fully paid-up Simpsons wad. It just didn't chime with me. It seemed unrelatable in many ways, and I don't know whether that was me being British and it being American, and the sort of focus on Bart Simpson in the early, at least the first couple of seasons, just didn't hook me, didn't really interest me. Eventually I saw the episode Bart the Daredevil, and this is one of the ones where Homer starts to come to the fore, and also of course features Truckosaurus, always a bonus, but yeah, Homer's iconic tumble down Springfield Gorge certainly had me hooked, and from there I've I think around season three, I mean, this is what you hear from most Simpsons fans, obviously, and I wish I could put forward a different viewpoint, but those were the glory days. Season three through to about season 9-10 That was where it was at for me. So looking forward to going through some episodes of The Simpsons, sort of the nostalgia factor, as you said before, and distracting ourselves from World War III, which started this weekend gone, and hopefully entertaining all our listeners on the way.
Just to give some context, we're recording this in April 2018, so the events we're going to be talking about are pretty much 30 years ago. So this is how far back we're going to have to go, and it just amazes me how long The Simpsons has been running for. Because I think what certainly attracted me to The Simpsons, and what gives it its lasting appeal, is that, and I can't remember where I originally heard this, but someone said that family sitcoms, especially American family sitcoms, they presented an ideal of the American family. I was going to use The Cosby Show as an example, but I probably shouldn't do that now that we know what we know about Bill Cosby. So the Waltons, I think, is a better example. So they were presenting this ideal of what American family life should be, and The Simpsons didn't do that. The Simpsons presented a satire on American family life, so people could really, really relate to it. I mean, the amount of times I saw my dad sitting on his chair, drinking some beer, and then suddenly belching, and my mum going, "Thank you for that, Homer."
Yeah, I think the fact that it is sort of a, I was about to say cartoonish, it is of course a cartoon, but a more exaggerated sort of warts and all sort of representation of the American family makes it more universally relatable, I guess. Especially as time goes on and sort of the adult characters come more to the fore. Returning for a second though to your point about the Waltons, there is of course the iconic quote from George, do we call him H.W. Bush now? George Bush Classic?
George Bush 1.0.
That's the one, yeah. Where he said that the American family, I'm probably paraphrasing here, but the American family should be more like the Waltons and less like the Simpsons. Which led to an immediate attack on him by the Simpsons. Then later on, of course, he had his own episode. I think they could have been harsher to him in that. I think he got off quite lightly.
He did, yeah. I remember in that clip, they play George H.W. Bush saying, "Americans should be more like the Waltons and less like the Simpsons." And then Homer goes, "What?" And Bart says, "Hey, we are just like the Waltons. We're waiting for the recession to end too."
And perhaps that's something that we'll actually see if we do go through all 30 years of The Simpsons on this podcast. We might see history start to repeat itself. There'll certainly be various financial calamities going through, various presidential mishaps. Be interesting to see if there's any patterns in there as well.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, growing up, the character that I most related with was Lisa Simpson, because she's a nerd, she's a vegetarian, she subscribed to Junior Skeptic magazine.
I forgot all about that. Yeah, I can see why that might have run.
Yeah, absolutely. So she's being skeptical of everything, and she's a real fish out of water character. And like I say, I just empathise with that so much. And Bart as well. Bart is a lot more like my little brother. And I've already said about Homer being like my dad. And I guess by default that means that Marge was like my mum. So I think most families who've seen it, the Simpsons resonates with them. But I remember being in similar experience to you, because I didn't immediately like it. My mum really hated it because according to her, they were always eating purple food. And I think there's one episode where they eat purple food, and that's because they weren't. One of the nice things about it is that you can see how the animation evolves and how they get better at it over time. So I think in an early episode, they were just eating purple food because just splodges of purple, that was easy to draw. Whereas a bit later on, they start drawing real food, and you know, and the drawing of the characters becomes more consistent, and the voices become more consistent. And it's just really interesting to see. Talking about the shorts, the only short I've ever seen is the very first one, and I've only seen that because it's in one of those clip shows that Troy McClure hosts.
Yes, it's in The Simpsons 138th episode Spectacular, and that's the only place I've seen the shorts as well. So there were five of the shorts were shown in that, but Good Night, which is the one that I imagine you'll be referring to, which was actually the very first one that was shown on Tracy Ullman, that was shown in full, whereas there was only clips of the other ones in the 138th episode Spectacular. So, they're not actually that readily available. Some of them were released on the VHSs of The Simpsons, but there's actually a lot of rights issues around the Tracy Ullman show itself, which has led to the entire show not actually being released on DVD, which is a bit of a shame, particularly for Simpsons completists. So without further ado, shall we take a look at said shorts and the genesis of The Simpsons as part of the Tracy Ullman show?
Absolutely, go for it.
Excellent. Okay, so I guess I should probably explain who Tracy Ullman is. Tracy Ullman is a British comedienne who was originally seen on British television in a couple of sketch shows. There was one called A Kick Up the 80s that had Miriam Margolyes, who was later of the Harry Potter films, and Rick Mayall, who was later of Richard fame, and also Three of a Kind, where she was joined by Lenny Henry and David Copperfield. She also had a singing career in the UK, which I very, very vaguely remember. I don't think I could certainly not whistle one of the tunes. Yeah, so that was an odd avenue for her. But she has the distinction of being the first British woman to be offered her own television sketch show in the US. And the Tracy Ullman show was it, airing on the Fox network when that was a relatively new thing. The show had sketches, song and dance numbers, variety acts, and animated segments. They were introduced to buffer the show into and out of commercial. And of course, we all remember, well, except me, who didn't have American television or Sky or anything like that, but we all remember, aside from that, tuning into the first episode of the Tracy Ullman show and seeing that fantastic animated short, everyone's favourite, went on to be so good, Dr. Ngudatu. Yes, for there was another animated short that was involved in the Tracy Ullman show in episodes 1, 2, and variously throughout season 1, which means that The Simpsons didn't actually debut until episode 3, which was broadcast on April the 19th, 1987. So, a little bit about the creation of this stage. So, one of the credited producers of Tracy Ullman was, and this is a name that will ring a bell to most Simpsons fans, James L. Brooks. He was a producer on Tracy Ullman, and he would go on to produce The Simpsons when it gets its own full animated series. The opening titles of the Tracy Ullman show were animated by the Klasky Supo animation company. They animated the Simpsons shorts as well, so there's a lot of doubling up going on here. They would go on to animate the show itself until 1992, when they were replaced by Film Roman. And that's one of the reasons why the show's sort of animation style and drawing style changes relatively abruptly around that time. It's simply because it was a different animation company. You could sort of see Klasky Supo's more sort of scratchy, I think it's quite a charming animation style especially in the shorts, but also in the early series of The Simpsons. But you may remember them from Nickelodeon's Nicktoons, including Rugrats, The Wild Thornberrys, and Ah, Real Monsters, which is really more of a showcase for their kind of style. And they also did, and I didn't even realise this until I was looking them up for this podcast, but they also did Duckman. Do you remember Duckman?
Duckman? No, Duckman, that escapes me, I'm afraid.
That was a another American animation. It was about a it was aimed at adults, so there was a sort of swearing and nudity and that kind of thing. But it was about a private detective who was also an anthropomorphic duck, and was essentially not a very nice, I was about to say not a very nice human being, but well, he's a duck. But even by duck standards, not a very nice piece of work, but also a committed family man. A lot of playing with the duality. But it was good. I'd recommend people give it a go. So that's how everybody got on board. Matt Groening, I probably should have started with Matt Groening, but Matt Groening, who created The Simpsons, he came to the attention of James L. Brooks through his comic strip Life in Hell. Do you remember Life in Hell, Tom, the one with the rabbits?
I know of Life in Hell through The Simpsons, yes, and Life in Hell characters, they sort of pop up as they have little cameo roles in early episodes, from what I remember.
They do, yes, and even as far forward as Futurama, they were still appearing. Life in Hell, then, started as a self-published comic in 1977. It's best known for its rabbit characters, including Binky, which was a sort of a facsimile for Matt himself. Also, Jeff and Akbar, who were two fez-wearing characters that came from a failed attempt to draw Charlie Brown. So they asked him to do Life in Hell for Tracy Ullman, but he didn't want Fox to get the merchandising rights to Life in Hell. So they said, do you have any other characters? And he made The Simpsons, based loosely on his own family. Why are The Simpsons yellow?
Ooh, why are The Simpsons yellow? I have a feeling I should know this, but I don't.
Well, see, to be honest, I thought there'd be some kind of magical story behind this, but it's actually just one of the animators at Klasky Supo, a gentleman called, and I'm going to attempt to pronounce this, Georgi Peluche, I'm going to go for, gave the family yellow skin and Marge blue hair in an attempt to make it distinctive from anything that had come before it. And in doing so, he accidentally gave a 31-year pop culture phenomenon its original visual hook. And one hopes he was well rewarded for that, and one suspects he possibly wasn't. But yes, so throughout the shorts, the All-American Family, Patriarch Homer, I am going to go through this, even though people already know this. So, Patriarch Homer, struggling to stamp his authority on his own household, model homemaker Marge, and children Bart and Lisa, who at this stage were basically the same character as each other. Lisa wouldn't be given her quirks until they actually came to make the series. And the mute infant Maggie. They have a number of wacky yet recognisably grounded adventures, which all go by very quickly as they've only got about a minute. There were 48 shorts in total. The last one was aired at the end of season 3 of the Tracy Ullman Show on May the 14th, 1989. Season 4 went without The Simpsons except for one repeated short, because by then The Simpsons, spoilers again, had its own animated show. And the last thing that I just want to mention is about the actors. So the same principal voice cast has actually been with the show right the way through, despite threatening to quit on several occasions, which is the May rise. Dan Castellaneta, who voices Homer and various other characters, including Grandpa and Krusty the Clown, both of whom appeared in the shorts, and Julie Kavner, who voices Marge, were both members of the Tracy Ullman Show's cast. So to save hiring any new actors, they just used them. Tracy Ullman was asked to voice Marge, but didn't have the time to do it, owing to all her other work on her show. Nancy Cartwright is an actress who auditioned for the role of Lisa, didn't feel a connection to the part, and asked to read for Bart, and was apparently hired on the spot, and she is, to this day, the iconic voice of Bart Simpson. And Yeardley Smith, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, actually, could be Yardley, but she was hired for Lisa, and I really wanted to mention this, because her greatest achievement up until that date was appearing in Stephen King's 1986 film Maximum Overdrive.
Wow.
Which, have you seen that, Tom? Or
it's, no.
It's amazing. Well, it's rubbish, but it's amazing rubbish. It's all about machines and cars attacking humans. And it's got a soundtrack by AC/DC. It's just Stephen King at his sort of coked up, most ridiculous. So everyone now, go out and watch Duckman, but first go and watch Maximum Overdrive. You can get from there. And Yeardley Smith would later feature in the sitcom Herman's Head, which is another one only I seem to remember, which is kind of like a 90s version of The Numbskulls, which of course makes it a spiritual forerunner of Pixar's Inside Out.
Okay. Yeah, this is all new to me, I've got to say. A film featuring cars attacking people starring Lisa Simpson. Sounds amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be seen for that alone, quite frankly. So the Tracy Ullman show was actually broadcast on BBC Two, but they had to cut the show for time reasons. And guess what got cut out?
Oh, really?
The Simpsons, and of course the other animated short that was involved, were cut out every time they were rebroadcast on BBC Two. So there we go. Tracy Ullman apparently also begged BBC Two to, or the BBC in general, to buy the rights to The Simpsons when Fox was selling them, but was unable to convince them, and off it went to Sky. Another quick piece of trivia for you, the short Punching Bag, that's number 33, we all remember that one, of course, that never seen, nor of you, and nor of most people, which aired on November the 27th, 1988, features the first time Homer says... annoyed grunt. And that, I believe, is everything that I know and have researched about the Tracy Ullman shorts of The Simpsons, which ran, just to recap, between 19th of April 1987 and the 14th of May 1989. So my question to you, Tom, is what was going on in the world?
Right, okay. So what was going on in the world that time? Now, the way you have to put 1989 into context is pretty much the whole order of the world that had existed for more than 40 years was completely changing. Now, before I start telling these stories, I have to say once again, I'm not a proper historian. I'm not a historian by any measure. So what I'm going to do is just give a really short overview of what was going on. And this is what we're going to do for every episode. I'm going to give a short overview of what was going on so people can go out and find out for themselves, you know, the real details. So in 1989, the way the world was set up, essentially, was you had the United States and its allies in the West, the capitalist West versus the USSR, so the communist East. And not just the USSR, which comprised mostly of Russia, but also lots of other countries which are now independent. So countries like Ukraine, Belarus, the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. People look at the Baltic states and they think, oh yeah, they're two, you know, they're three little countries just up in the north somewhere. They can't be very interesting. To me, the Baltic states are absolutely fascinating. So we'll talk about them in a later episode. So you also had all the Stans in Central Asia. All of the countries that always do really well on the quiz show Pointless. So Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan. So all of them were in a union called the USSR. Some of them were, you know, incorporated against their will, especially the Baltic states. And as well as the USSR, you had the Soviet sphere of influence. So after the Second World War finished back in 1945, what Churchill described as an iron curtain came down across Eastern Europe. So the USSR ended up more or less taking control. A lot of them became puppet states of countries like Poland, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Romania. Romania is very important. We'll definitely talk about that later. And famously East Germany. So you had these two main power blocks involved in the Cold War. And of course you have the space race. You had East and West racing their technologies against each other with the ultimate target, of course, being to get to the moon. Now, I really love looking at the space race, because one of the fascinating things about it was just how close the USSR got to winning it. Because if you look at what they did almost everything first. They were the first people to put a man in space. Yuri Gagarin, of course, first people to launch an artificial satellite, Sputnik 1, first people to put a probe on the moon, The only thing they didn't do first was put a man on the moon. So you have the space race, which was East versus West. And growing up in the Cold War must have been a really, really terrifying time for a lot of people, because Second World War saw the first use of nuclear weapons, you know, when the States famously bombed Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Oh, one thing I should say, that when I talk about history, I'm going to try and be apolitical. I'm just going to try and tell the stories. I'm not going to try and judge. So was it right that the US dropped nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki? I know what I think, but I'm not going to try and ask or answer those questions.
It's also probably worth pointing out at this stage that I am the control idiot for this part of the podcast. I grew up during a lot of these events, but I have deliberately not revisited them so that I can ask stupid questions for general hilarity purposes.
Excellent.
But one thing I would like to just mention is that that is my main memory of growing up during the Cold War, is the constant threat of mutually assured destruction. it seemed like every day I was being told the bomb was about to drop and to duck and cover, which I don't really think would have done much. Pretty sure I still would have wound up dead, but you know, luckily we will probably shouldn't say we will never know. Luckily, we didn't get to find out during said Cold War.
No, we didn't. We didn't. There were areas where there were times when we got perilously close. There was the Cuban Missile Crisis in the 60s when the Soviet Union, which was allied with Cuba. Cuba had recently undergone the Cuban Revolution. You know, Castro took over, and Castro allowed the Soviet Union to essentially park their nuclear missiles on Cuba. And Cuba's like 90 miles away from Florida, or something like that. So there was this massive standoff. Everyone was worried that the world was on the brink of nuclear war. Eventually, the Soviets backed down, the missiles left, and you know, things cooled off a bit. But yeah, everyone must have been terrified of this idea that someone says the wrong thing, presses the wrong button, whatever, you know, and a missile is shot over the ocean from either the States or from Russia. The other side retaliates, and everyone's dead very quickly. So yeah, that was a big fear in the '80s. In fact, I think there's an episode of The Simpsons where Bart sells his soul and Marge hugs him and trying to work out what's wrong with him, and she says it's not fear of nuclear war.
Well, by then it probably wouldn't have been. I guess it would have been fading by the time that one was shown.
Oh, it certainly would have been by the early 90s. But one of the things that the Soviets operated during the existence of the Soviet Union was something that was called the Brezhnev Doctrine, which is this idea that if the USSR or any of the states of the USSR or any of the satellite states in the Eastern Bloc, the Warsaw Pact, it was called, if any Warsaw Pact country wanted to, say, break away from the socialist / communist model of running the country, if any of them wanted to do that, then the other Warsaw Pact countries could invade, bring the tanks in, kick out the government, and retake control of that country. And that happened a few times. That happened in East Germany, that happened in Hungary, and that famously happened in Czechoslovakia in the Prague Spring, which I believe was in 1965.
Oh, I see. So it was kind of self-perpetuating then.
Yes. So yeah, the Warsaw Pact countries, with the exception of one, with the exception of Romania, were pretty much just puppets who did whatever the USSR told them to do, essentially. But by the time of the 80s, the Brezhnev Doctrine was abandoned, mainly by Mikhail Gorbachev, and it got replaced by what was jokingly called the Sinatra Doctrine, which was named after Frank Sinatra, as in I did it my way. So there was this idea that the Eastern Bloc countries could do things their way. But once they realised that they could, you had a bit of a domino effect. So I can't remember which country was first, but as soon as one went, then they all went. And some of these revolutions were quite peaceful. Others, as we'll find out in the next episode, were exceptionally bloody. So in fact, the Berlin Wall, which was very much the symbol of the Cold War, the Berlin Wall came down in November 1989, I believe, which was just a few weeks before the first full episode of The Simpsons was broadcast.
Yeah, the first full episode. And as I touched on earlier, the only one to be broadcast in the 80s was broadcast on the 17th of December 1989. And we'll get into why that particular episode was the first episode and why it was then in our next edition. But yes, so the Berlin Wall coming down was almost immediately before that happened.
What I find amazing about the whole Cold War period is that the USSR, you had states and a system of government that just doesn't exist anymore and just went overnight. So you went from having, you know, this very understood order of East versus West, capitalist versus communist. And when communism crumbled in the late 80s and early 90s, that all just went. And it's almost as if we're still trying to understand what the order of the world is now, because it went from being, right, you were either with America or the USSR, to being with, well, you can't be with the USSR anymore because they're gone. And, you know, and USSR allies, notably Cuba and North Korea, they lost their main ally. And it must have been very, very, very tough for them. What was happening in the world in 1989, and especially with what was happening in Germany, because I find the history of post-war Germany, I find that fascinating because of what happened at the end of the war. Because usually when two countries go to war, there'll be a declaration of war, they'll fight for a bit, one of them will realise that they can't win, and therefore they'll talk to the other side, they'll have an armistice, they'll agree to stop fighting, and then they'll sort out a peace treaty. And, you know, they'll give up a bit of land or something like that. And, you know, lots of wars were fought like that, especially in the 19th century. But at the end of the Second World War, the Nazis were just completely annihilated. They fought to the last man. And it finished with the Soviets occupying the Reichstag. And, you know there's that famous photo of the soldier with the red flag over the Reichstag, signifying the end of the Second World War. So with Germany, there was no government to negotiate with. So what happened was Germany was divided into quarters, and you had a quarter for the British, the Americans, the French, and the Soviet Union. And you had Berlin, capital of Germany, which was slap bang in the Soviet sector. That itself was divided into four. So you had this absolutely ridiculous situation of having a city roughly the size of Birmingham, cut in half, and having one half of it belonging to a country that was hundreds of miles away, and the other half being the capital of the country that it was in. And that situation lasted for just over 40 years. And with West Berlin, the people who found themselves inside what later became East Germany, the German Democratic Republic, GDR, DDR in German, a lot of them didn't want to stay in East Germany. I think East Germany lost about 20% of its population during what was referred to as the brain drain. And at first you could just pack up and go, and then obviously the authorities stopped people doing that. And then the only way to get into West Germany from Yeast was to go to Berlin and just get into West Berlin any way you could. And once you were in West Berlin, that was it. You were fine. You were in West Germany. You could go. So to put a stop to this, the East German authorities put up the Berlin Wall. And it went up overnight. And there are some really horrific stories about it. There's one story where you had a couple of parents just gave birth to a baby in a West German hospital, in a West Berlin hospital, but they lived in East Berlin. So gave birth to a baby. They went home. The baby stayed in the hospital in West Berlin. They went back to East Berlin. And then the wall went up and they couldn't see their baby. So, yeah, you have stories like that, which are absolutely horrible. And I don't know if you've ever been to Berlin, but it's amazing because you can go to a city that was once completely divided. West Berlin was completely ringed in, completely ring fenced to stop people getting from the east to the west. And now you can do that because the Berlin Wall eventually fell in 1989. And I'm going to talk about it in more detail in a later episode. But because it eventually fell and German unification occurred, all of that happened in the early 90s. And it all happened really, really quickly. You went from the situation which again, everyone knew about. Everyone knew what would happen if you tried to cross the Berlin Wall, to the whole East German state, the whole East German government, the way the country worked, basically, all going and all coming under the jurisdiction of Germany as a whole. So all of the whole Eastern Bloc, it all went in the late 80s, early 90s, and it all went very, very quickly. So that, for me, is why this period of history is absolutely fascinating, because of how much everything changed.
I think you can't underestimate as well the impact of the Berlin Wall on popular culture in general. And also the whole sort of Soviet versus American Cold War. Hollywood, music, kind of any sort of repository of popular culture was influenced by this world situation. And it's strange now to hear and see some of the things from the time, in a time where we've been longer without the Berlin Wall and without the Soviet Union. Certainly in my lifetime, I've been longer without it than I was with it. It's a really fascinating situation. I'm really looking forward to hearing about it, and not just because I've got a podcast to sell.
Superb. Well, I think that'll do for a pilot episode. So if you want to get in touch with the show, you can email us at podcast@retrospecticus.org.
All that remains is to say goodbye, I guess. So I've been Gareth Irons. You can catch me at Atomic Sourpuss.
And I've been Tom Williamson. You can find me at skepticcanary.com.
And we have been Retrospecticus. We'll see you next time.